You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here on a boat en route between Columbia and Panama. That's right, I'm working on the National Geographic expedition right now between Cartagena and Panama City. So very exciting there too. But this is episode 449 of the Columbia Calling podcast. We've got double news from Emily Hart this week. And also in the third segment, we're talking to the director of Columbia Reports, Adrian Alsema, about the conversation, well, the suggestion that is being given out by, well, not only President Santos, former President Gaviria, and also current President Gustavo Petro on the legalization of cocaine. So we're discussing that and what this could mean for Colombia. So don't go away. Great conversation in the pipeline for you now.
I'm Emily Hart, and since we missed the news last week, here are your top stories from the first 2 weeks of November 2022. President Gustavo Petro has now been in power for 100 days. Invermere's new poll gives Petro a public approval rating of 50%, with disapproval at 43%. For comparison, the last approval measurement of former President Iván Duque in June earlier this year was at 28%. Petro is best perceived in the Caribbean with 60% approval ratings, while in the Central East he has only 36%. Young people between 18 and 24 years old are the most supportive, though the variations by age and economic status are much less significant than regional variations. During these first 3 months, the country has seen the passing of the tax reform bill, aiming to raise 20 trillion extra pesos next year, and the passing of the total peace law, paving the way to peace talks with political groups like the ELN and criminal groups like the AGC. The approval of the new budget and the ratification of the Escazú Accord are also significant as steps to the fulfillment of Petro's ambitious agenda. However, also this month, and for the fifth time, an attempt to ban bullfighting in Colombia has been sunk in Congress, as animal rights activists question the lack of support, even from progressive representatives. Petro promised in his campaign to end any spectacle involving animals. On the wider perception of the country's situation, 60% of respondents believe that things in the country are going badly. Indeed, the survey was taken as the peso tumbled to a record low of 5,070 Colombian pesos to the US dollar in the first week of November. And the economy continues to be the greatest concern for Colombians, with 38% of votes from respondents, followed by corruption with 18%, insecurity with 13%, and poverty with 6%. A large majority, 68%, defend petrol subsidies in spite of the program's deficit for the public purse. The government has actually already been withdrawing those subsidies. 54% of those polled reject the idea of stopping oil and gas exploration, another flagship policy for this new government. Though same-sex marriage has been legal in the country since 2016, it has the support of only 39% of citizens and a rejection of 56%. 56% are also against the legalization of recreational cannabis, and 68% are against the legalization and regulation of cocaine. Human Rights Watch also released a report marking Petro's first 3 months in office, showing that 35 social leaders have been murdered in that time. Nariño is the department with the most violence against social leaders, according to the report, with 8 homicides in that department. This year's unusually intense rainy season in Colombia, aggravated by La Niña weather phenomenon, continues to cause major damage and disruption. The president himself met this weekend with ministers to make plans to manage the situation, which has so far left more than 200 people dead and nearly 500,000 people affected. There are 281 injured and more than 50 missing, as well as around 6,000 homes destroyed and nearly 80,000 homes damaged, along with thousands of roads, hundreds of bridges, more than 300 aqueducts and 250 schools. It is reportedly the most serious winter wave the country has faced in nearly half a century, and deaths far exceed those of recent years. The rains caused 126 deaths in 2021 and 96 in 2020. In the first 10 days of November alone, nearly 14,000 people were affected by floods, gales, flash floods and landslides, especially in the Caribbean and Andean regions. One of the most critical situations this month took place in Cartagena. Last month, the executive declared a state of national disaster, a measure allowing a reallocation of budget resources to assist the affected population. It's been announced that 2.1 billion pesos, which is around $414 million, will be allocated to face the emergency, to be invested in food, health services, and relocation of victims. The president has also announced that it is likely that this winter wave and its accompanying rains will extend up to even April of next year. Colombia's President Gustavo Petro and Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro held their first bilateral meeting in 6 years earlier this month. The two spoke behind closed doors and then made a public statement without taking questions from the press, supposedly having discussed trade, human rights, and protecting the Amazon rainforest. Maduro emphasized the commercial relationship between the two countries and the need to strengthen the border. Meanwhile, Petro called on the Venezuelan government to rejoin the Inter-American human rights system and to build a truly liberal democracy, reportedly also asking Maduro to carry out free elections in Venezuela. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights is the body responsible for recommending and promoting respect for human rights by its member states. It was not, reportedly, until Maduro agreed to discuss rejoining the court, that Petro agreed to visit Caracas. This political opening is, however, in stark contrast to a new UN report which concluded that a network of clandestine houses in Venezuela tortured political opponents. The report points directly to Maduro as responsible for giving the orders to commit crimes against humanity. Public transport in Colombia is not a safe place for women and girls. Already this month, two minors were sexually abused on the Transmilenio, Bogotá's public transport system. Nearly 6,000 sexual crimes have been reported in Bogotá already this year, according to the Security Secretariat. The alleged abuser of one of the two minors was captured and charged with the crimes of violent carnal access and aggravated theft. The man had been arrested for obscene sexual acts on transport less than 2 weeks before, but had been released by the prosecutor. Hours after being arrested by the police, the man was found dead in the police station where he was being detained, held with 80 other inmates in a cell. The autopsy confirmed he had been murdered, suggesting he'd been beaten to death. The police have announced an investigation. A survey indicated that 84% of women say they feel very insecure or insecure using the Transmilenio. 39% have decided not to use the buses for fear of suffering some kind of sexual violence. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is episode 449 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Our guest this week needs no introduction, of course. It's the one, the only, Adrian Alsamer of Colombia Reports. We are going to be talking about, well, you know, we've left it a little bit late, but this UN report that came out in October that shows how, well, the coca cultivation, so coca, of course, the crop with which they make cocaine. Coca cultivation has increased in Colombia in a recent UN report that says by 43%. So Adrian and I are going to discuss that. Welcome back on the show, Adrian.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome. So, I mean, 43%, Adrian, that's a huge amount. I mean, that's not far off 50%. It's not far off. What's going on?
What's going on is that the government the previous government really put its money on repressive coca cultivation reduction, which has never worked. And the recent statistics confirm what everybody's been saying for a decade, which is that it doesn't work.
Yeah. But we're gonna get people like, you know, you and I have a couple of trolls, and they'll get saying, well, it's because there's no more glyphosate spraying, and if there's no more glyphosate spraying, that won't get rid of the coca crops and so on. So there's no will to do so, and the peace accords have failed in that there's no crop substitution. What do we say to those people?
Those people need to read the final report of the Truth Commission, mm-hmm. Which delved deeply into the history of counter-narcotics in Colombia. Mm-hmm. And what you see, which is really interesting, the use of glyphosate got really big in the late 1990s. And, mm-hmm. and this happened after a breakdown of diplomatic ties between Colombia and the United States because of the so-called 8000 process, which was a scandal that erupted in 1994 because of the financial contributions of the Cali cartel to mm-hmm. the presidential election campaign of Liberal Party candidate Ernesto Samper. Mm-hmm. What happened is that before that scandal, so before 1994, when the cartels were still active, yeah. all counter-narcotics was targeting drug traffickers and cartels like the Medellin cartel and the Cali cartel. And what happened like during after the U.S. authorities found out that the Cali cartel was bankrolling politicians in Colombia, including the president, diplomatic relations kind of broke down. And they kind of resumed with a new strategy that sought to go after coca farmers rather than drug traffickers. And this has since been the strategy, and it hasn't worked since the beginning. There is no correlation to a drop in cocaine production and aerial spraying. Like it just doesn't exist. So there's just no evidence to indicate that like the aerial spraying of herbicides has any effect on cocaine production.
And I mean, that's an awesome point, because you said that this the spraying really picked up at the end of the 1990s. And correct. If we're looking at this UN report from October, and it's called the 43% increase of coca cultivation, these are the highest figures since 2001. That correlates with what you're saying.
You might want to like this whole fixation on hectares is also like a result of that strategy. Like what matters is like how much cocaine is being produced. Mm-hmm. So if you measure in hectares, so like how much land is being used for the cultivation of coca, you don't take into account crop density, like the quality of the crop, and you get like a really indirect indication of like how the illicit drug trade is doing. Mm. So what the UN also came up with another statistic, which is like much more of a more of an indication of how cocaine production is going, like beyond coca cultivation. And last year, the production of cocaine, the potential cocaine production was 1,400 metric tons of cocaine. So a metric ton is it's pretty much like, well, it's fucking huge. Like one metric ton is all, like, if I'm correct, that's a meter by a meter by a meter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a lot of cocaine.
Yeah.
If you compare this, like, for example, to 1995, in 1995, only 230 tons of cocaine were produced. So we're going from if you look at the beginning of Plan Colombia, like if we take 1999, then it's already like increased 680, and now it's 1400, so more than double than what it was like at the turn of the century. And it's whatever has been done has evidently failed. And this includes relatively new strategies that were employed as part of the peace process that included the voluntary substitution of cocaine crops.
Yeah,
because because there's been a diversion of attention to the cultivation of cocaine. This is taking resources away from law enforcement targeting drug trafficking networks or drug trafficking routes. There's a whole weird assumption in the United States. In the United States, which remains the biggest cocaine consumer in the world, that like cocaine is entering the U.S. via the Mexican border, and that's just not the case. If you look at the interdictions that were done during the shutdown of the during the coronavirus pandemic in the first months, you notice that U.S. interdictions almost like collapsed. But drug trafficking did not collapse. If you compare this to Europe, where authorities are monitoring the seaports, they noticed an increase. So you can only assume that also in the U.S., cocaine is entering the country via the ports of Newark or Los Angeles and Seattle. But there's a weird fixation on the Mexican border, like, which is where other drugs are coming in the country. Not relevant for Colombian cocaine.
Yeah, I mean, we just quickly say there's a whole load of the artificial drugs coming through from Mexico, and the opiates and fentanyl and all of these things are coming through now, I think, from that one. So, yeah, but, I mean, when you talked about the hectares, problem, go on.
Well, the problem with if you accept that illegal drugs and cocaine in particular enter the country via the ports, then you also have to admit that you can't do anything about it. If you look at the sheer volume of shipping containers that enter any given port, be it Rotterdam in the Netherlands or Newark in New Jersey, you can't possibly spend like 2 seconds per container because like you just shut down the entire global trade. And that's basically what you need to accept as a reality, there's nothing, you can't stop drug trafficking without completely collapsing global, normal trade, like food and stuff.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I was up in Panama recently and then down in the port of Cartagena, and you just look at the quantity of containers stacked up there and what amount of time would be required to check container by container. With days, months, if not years, as you say, it would collapse everything.
It's just not possible. Like you can't you can't spend not even like 2 seconds per container. It's impossible. So the whole attempt to do it anyway, is just futile. And the whole drug problem, which is very real, the drug abuse and drug addiction are very real problems. Also when it comes to cocaine, even though it's a relatively mild drug, it's not like heroin. You need the fact that we're still not having a public health based approach to drug consumption makes every form of law enforcement completely futile. It's just nonsensical.
So I like the way you've taken this about the hectares and acres, and we just get those figures out there. So if we read, for example, on the BBC, or, obviously they've done a summary of the reports, 204,000 hectares or 504,100 acres. It's an irrelevant. I mean, obviously it gives us an idea, but as you say, the density of growth and the quality of growth, and these plants are incredibly, durable plants as well. And of course, it doesn't make that much sense, I think. And as you say, law enforcement.
And also there's been a massive change in cultivation. So there's been genetical modification to increase the yield per crop. And there's all kinds of stuff you can do with a genetic modification that benefits the end product, which is cocaine. So the whole focus on how much land is being used is completely outdated.
Yeah, but that seems to be most of the arguments as well on the so-called war on drugs. It's a policy that has been created and somewhat modified over the years, but at the base we'll find the farmers guilty, it's the addicts, it's, and so on, and I think this is where we get into President Petro's speech at the UN. Obviously he was speaking during the few days of spring that he had as president, and the feeling of optimism, and he was speaking from a position of strength right then, and talking about the war on drugs. He didn't mention the US, but it was very it was very easily to let's say implied. In fact, I had a conversation briefly with someone from the embassy about that, and they were like, yes, he didn't say the US, they kept saying. He didn't say the US, but we know who they're talking about. But maybe you could give us a bit of a background on what Gustavo Petro said at the UN.
Gustavo Petro basically said that the UN, I'm sorry, that the war on drugs was a war on the environment, and was a war on a plant, which is kind of the case, because the thing is that initially counter-narcotics targeted drug trafficking organizations, which makes sense because they're evidently engaged in criminal activity, not just drug trafficking, but also money laundering. And all kinds of other criminal activity here in Colombia, like extortion and you name it, like typical mafia activity. And particularly during Plan Colombia between 1999 and 2006, there was the actual organized crime groups were just ignored, and all the resources went into combating the production the cultivation of coca, which is just senseless. It's really weird how that somehow got diverted away from because like there's nothing, nobody's against law enforcement, you know, like nobody is like, nobody opposes going after drug traffickers and money launderers. Well, good luck finding someone who thinks that's like ethically questionable, like they don't exist. But somehow like they stopped combating organized crime and focused on cultivation of coca. And this has in effect only strengthened organized crime to the extent that you can now say that the longest living drug trafficking organization in Colombia is the National Police. The corruption that is financed by the drug trade has completely eroded the capacity of the state to enforce the law.
It's one of those things, and of course, when we talk about the stigmatization of the small landowner, the campesino, poorly translated as peasant, I like to call them, you know, farmers, small holders. But it has the stigmatization of these guys who grow the crops out there, because the only people who get out there to buy products are the cartels. And that, I mean, that's part of the issue. And this comes into the whole debate around paz total or total peace. I mean, how can we have total peace, which is a cornerstone of Gustavo Petro's policy, Gustavo Petro's presidency, with this production of cocaine and also this failure to include the countryside? Well,
the prohibition of cocaine, and this is also what the Truth Commission pointed out, is that it's not so much the trade in commodity X, like cocaine. It's the fact that it's illegal, because like the fact that it's illegal, like it inflates the profit margin, and it's like something that would have been maybe a few dollars per kilo is now like $1,500 a kilo in Colombia, and fuck knows how much it costs in the United States or the UK or wherever. So the whole prohibition element is what is causing the problem, rather than the existence of cocaine, because cocaine's been around since forever. And its prohibition basically has counterproductive.
So, and I glean from my reading, and of course the dubious success stories, when certainly under the last presidency and last government, when they say, oh, this is the highest seizure of cocaine ever, it strikes me that there's more cocaine than the narco gangs know what to do with. That huge seizure they had some time ago up in northern Colombia in Urabá, that cocaine was just sitting there rotting. They didn't know. I mean, there's not enough transport to get all the stuff out. How do you feel about that?
Well, I've seen, I did an inventory last year here on cocaine seizures, like throughout the world. You would notice that during the pandemic, like new routes were created. So you, like over the past few years, like a lot of cocaine is now being trafficked to Brazil. Which has become like and not just Colombian cocaine, like this is also largely like Bolivian and Peruvian cocaine. And you notice like seizures of Colombian cocaine in Libya and in Pakistan. Dubai, if I'm correct, like Dubai or Qatar. So cocaine is just being like shipped all over the place, and from there like it can be shipped like to like the actual consumption markets in Europe and in the United States. So what I'm imagining is that a new strategy is to ship cocaine to a location where there is no consumption. From there, it's being shipped to a consumption market without like the red flags that are like on shipments, like banana shipments from Colombia, for example.
Yeah. So it's sending it to a second location first.
And because there's just so much cocaine being produced that it's exceeding like the potential consumption. So it looks like there are just like sort of like stash houses of cocaine in places where you really don't expect them. So like in the Middle East, in Africa.
Is Equatorial Guinea is one of the big places, isn't it? They've got a whole bunch of Colombians in jail there. And they, I mean, it's cheaper for them to fly planes across the Atlantic, crash them, get the cocaine out, you know, then it's just cheaper to leave, because the profit margin is so big, leave that plane there, crash.
Yeah, and it's not going to lose value. So cocaine is relatively, I mean, you can keep it for quite a while before it goes bad, and you can just like leave it sitting in Dubai for half a year and then move it to like wherever there's a customer. This makes like combating drug trafficking incredibly difficult, because like you just don't know like what the origin country is anymore of shipments that enter your country.
It's true, under flags of convenience and so on. But so, I mean, if we talk about, you know, President Santos, when he was on, let's say, on the way out of his presidency, and he mentioned, you know, to Obama, you know, it's time to talk about legalization. It's time to talk about these things. Of course, he was on the way out, and he was on, you know, again, on a high post-peace accord. He could say these things, and he continues to say these things on a world stage, but of course, he's no longer president. But we have a president now who is talking about we need to really seriously discuss, well, I guess is it a regulation or a legalization? How do you want to put this?
It's the same thing. Like regulation is just like a way to avoid saying legalization. But the tragic thing is that like Colombia doesn't really have another option. I mean, like if you look at the destruction caused by the illicit drug trade, like how it finances armed groups and how it's created this perpetual violence that's financed by cocaine exports. We are condemning ourselves to perpetual violence if we don't come up with a functional strategy. And the tragedy of this is, if you look at the United States, if you look at the number of drug overdoses in the United States, like this is like mind-boggling. If you compare this to European countries, for example. So it's kind of tragic. Like if the United States can't figure out a way to lower consumption and do kind of like a harm reduction, then Colombia can't. Like it's completely unacceptable that we would have to suffer like this perpetual violence because another country like a few thousand miles away can't figure out how to provide public health.
Yeah. And now, I mean, you've mentioned it a few times, and this perpetual violence and so on. If I'm not mistaken, and of course, money laundering doesn't get you extradited to the US, does it? The crime of money laundering.
I suppose it could. It's just not being pursued. Like that. Okay. That's another thing. Like there's a, with the increase of cocaine exports, there's also an increase of money, like drug money flows coming back to Colombia. And if you look at how law enforcement is targeting that half of the drug trade, it's just non-existent. Like it's completely evading all kinds of detection. And because there's like a, people are not, well, in general, like people are not as aware of money laundering as they are of drug trafficking.
Yeah.
Even though like it's literally like half of the trade. If you somehow are able to effectively end money laundering, then the whole drug trade collapses because like nobody is going like drug trafficking is not a charitable thing, you know, like it's all about the money.
So if we, go on.
Well, and this is completely ignored by federal authorities in the United States, also by the European Central Bank in Brussels, and also in Colombia. There's just
it's just rife.
And law enforcement just doesn't exist. So what that's concerned, I just don't see like how people can claim that they are actually combating drug trafficking when they are not combating money laundering.
Yeah, I mean, so if we approach this from two prongs, it's a public health concern, the consumption and so on. And then the issue of money laundering, then we're looking at, you know, a serious way of not combating, but how do we, I don't know, create some sort of new vision of a problem. So I find it could be very interesting on that level. And the whole issue of money laundering, I brought it up because you know, I put a microphone up and one of my kids sees me. But if we talk about money laundering, it doesn't seem to be the possibility of actually investigating it. I mean, the only time that we've seen it, obviously, we saw the money going into the Samper campaign and the other campaigns in politics. But let's just go to the anecdote of the former Colombian ambassador to Uruguay. You know, he's of the Colombian upper class, San Clemente, and he was found to
former director of the Civil Aviation Authority.
He was as well, wasn't he? Before that, and then he was the director of like the Transmilenio for a bit. So they get passed around between these top jobs, you know, especially when they're of these elite families, and elite is a word and it tends to come up a lot in Colombia when we talk about the problems, the elite families. But this money laundering, he had cocaine laboratories on his family farm just outside of Bogota. And of course, the butler is the guy who's got sent down. And we don't really know where the case is going. And he's always claimed that innocence and that he didn't know. They're not actually that far from the main house, but this is the time where I feel that sort of very poor, that very gray area between money laundering and production have been shown with the sort of top end of Colombian society, because you sort of think
in the administration of government. I mean, like this guy was the director of all civilian flights coming in and out of Colombia, and the giving licenses to private airplanes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So rather than like this, like being an elite, I mean, like if you're into drug trafficking, like you're in the elite, like within a few minutes,
yeah.
Like, because it's just really profitable.
Same.
So like it's really, it's only natural that the mafia ends up infiltrating the elite because they have the resources to do so. But what is more importantly, because this is not a class thing, this is a matter of like how the mafia is infiltrating public administration. So like how they end up like controlling aviation authorities, how they corrupt port authorities, and making all kinds of like law enforcement, like when it comes to customs and imports and exports, completely impossible. I looked into like exports like from Colombia to the United States, and there's like a, over the past decade, there's a $30 billion gap between what Colombia says it exported to the United States and the money paid to Colombia for exports. So like the United States businesses are sending on average $3 billion to Colombia. That does not correspond to actual exports.
Huh.
So like I don't even know how you begin to investigate this, because like you're
It seems like a totally impossible situation on this level.
Markets to the production country.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it's not a class thing, and I don't think it's a class thing either, but I do think that the discrepancy between who is arrested and who is money laundering rather than producing does show a difference between
because if you've been successful in drug trafficking or money laundering, like you evidently have the resources to corrupt justice and corrupt the police and corrupt the prosecution. So you kind of end up like corrupting society as well, like where the upper class ends up like being the disproportionately involved in drug trafficking.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that they don't get their hands 100% dirty in, let's say, the production, and that's where I think that sort of crossover with San Clemente is so very interesting. You know, they get they're completely juntao, or you know, involved in the laundering side of things. You know, they were building their luxury apartments, restaurants, bars, whatever, you know, whatever they launder it through.
But the cartels, we're not even mentioning the banks. If you look at the Colombia's main banking corporations, they all have like incredibly intricate networks in the Caribbean. Based on the investigations by, for example, the Paradise Papers and the Panama Papers. And that just doesn't sit right, you know. Like if you're a bank and you're creating a whole network in the Caribbean, then what are you doing with that network? You know, like what is that used for? Because those networks are incredibly vulnerable for the use of like money laundering activities, and have been since the early 1980s. And there's very little you can do about it, because these countries are sovereign. Like you can't just like demand their bank records and stuff.
Yeah, and they're not giving up that information. I mean, that's how they exist.
Yeah, it's like how the entire Caribbean is financed. So you're looking at quite a challenge if you want to tackle that. For me, I mean, you could tackle it if you are able to monitor like money flows like entering the country or leaving consumption countries like the US or the UK or France or whatever. But that's not being done. If I'm correct, the estimate is that like only a percent of money laundering is actually being detected by global law enforcement. So that's a global average. Maybe it's 3%, but you can imagine like oiling the whole financial system.
But I mean, and of course, you know, no one's going to speak up on this. So, I mean, let's come back to Colombia. We've talked about it all. Where does Gustavo Petro go from here? We know it's a huge problem. We want to deal with it as a health problem. We don't want to stigmatize the smallholders. Where do we go? Because he'll continue to push this policy, which is correct, in my opinion. But it won't be.
Well, approved. What option does he have? The entire state, if you look at the military, like they're profoundly corrupted by drug trafficking. All army divisions on the Pacific coast are implicated in drug trafficking. Yeah. If you look at the port authority, all port authorities like in Buenaventura on the Pacific coast, Barranquilla, Santa Marta, and Cartagena on the Caribbean coast, these port authorities are up to their neck in drug trafficking allegations. So the whole functioning of government is being undermined by organized crime and drug trafficking in particular. Mm-hmm. So where Petro wants to go, he has said, for example, that he wants to make sure that the country's Colombia's intelligence agency, so the DIHIN and SIHIN of the police, the IND, which reports directly to the president, that they put their resources on organized crime rather than, for example, political opposition. And that is like the first time that a president has explicitly made this such a priority, like using state intelligence agencies to really put their resources on organized crime. Because if you don't clean up the state institutions, then you can't fight crime and you can't properly govern, because like your entire state apparatus is eroding.
He's going to come up against serious opposition.
Obviously.
I don't know how he's going to do it, but I think that the conversation and the dialogue is very positive. And I just feel that he's in a difficult time. I mean, on all sorts of different levels, but he's in a difficult time. But I think if he can continue the conversation, and I'm sure, I mean, the COP is going on.
Well, he's going to have to deliver results. It's cool that that we believe that what he says makes sense, but he still has to put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah.
So, what we're kind of waiting for is really high profile arrests, like army generals and prominent police officials. And that's very difficult because of the constant infiltration of the mafia in law enforcement.
But then,
if I may give an example, Petro did a real, he really cleaned up the top of the national police. When he took office, he, I believe, 20 or 25 top of the top police officials were ejected from the organization, because Petro wanted a woman a deputy police chief. What that does is like it removes like possible corrupt officials from the very top of the police. Mm-hmm. However, what it also does is it pushes lower ranked police officers up the chain, like up the ladder. Mm-hmm. And without proper vetting of these officials, so like you also bump up police officials of who you don't know like whether they are already co-opted by criminal interests or not. So that's a really difficult thing to fight.
He needs some big wins, doesn't he? And quite soon, Petro, I think he needs some big wins.
Well, not he, we do. Like organized crime is threatening society. It's financing illegal armed groups. It's completely eroding the legitimacy of government. We can't possibly have a country if we fail to address and combat organized crime.
So at the end of this, then, I mean, we have to continue to discuss legalization.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's it, isn't it? It has to be the discussion. It won't happen anytime soon, but the conversation
is happening. I mean, the if you look at how public opinion is gradually moving in favor of legalization, I mean, because it's the problem with that type of law is that it's like there's a moral element to it. Like people are like, cocaine is bad, so it should be banned. Mm-hmm. Which is a very normal way of thinking. But if it's not, if it doesn't work, if it actually like makes the problem worse, then you need a different approach.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm 100% in agreement with you. I just don't think that the cocaine, I think the dialogue will continue, but we're going to need greater weight behind it. And until something is done, obviously in the US, you know, we're kind of at the mercy here, being, you know, the number one partner for South America.
Well, but for that reason, Petro has really embarked on a diplomatic offensive within Latin America to create a sort of a regional bloc that has the diplomatic weight to basically decide for ourselves like how we are going to deal with this problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, obviously he's got, obviously there's Lula, Boric, I guess to some extent Lasso, Castillo, if he remains in Peru. I mean, they're trying to get him out so very fast. I guess there is a block of Fernandez to some extent in Argentina as well. So we will see. I mean, it's a complex time. And I can only hope that the dialogue continues and it's not pushed onto a back burner, because as you say, organized crime here in Colombia, and we see the reports coming out of more violence in Panama and more violence in Ecuador and so on. Obviously in Brazil, as a huge transshipment, but not only transshipment, it's now a consumer country, which it wasn't previously, you know. So anyway, and we're seeing that everywhere, because the domestic market for these countries is profitable as well. Not as profitable as the US or Europe, but it's profitable when you've got so much to sell, you know.
Yeah, because like with all... I mean, like that's kind of like the thing of capitalism. Like, if the demand doesn't exist, like, create it. You know, like, it's not that people need like Hershey chocolate. I mean, like, if it disappears tomorrow, like, nothing's going to happen. But you got all these marketing people like creating a demand, and clearly the illicit drug trade, like, is pure capitalism, and it will create markets where law enforcement is weak. So, like, if the U.S. is really effective in blocking the entry of cocaine, then Brazil has, like, I don't know how many fucking people, but there's, like, there will be plenty of people that want to snort cocaine there.
Oh yeah.
Not to mention Africa and Asia. Like, there will always be a market somewhere, and that's good. And that also is, like, what is increasingly complicating law enforcement, because like, it's not that, like, cocaine is, like, only going to the US. It's going fucking everywhere. So like, a national government, let's say the United States or Canada or Mexico, can't really do anything about, like, cocaine going from Colombia to Sierra Leone. You know, like, it's just not how, like, cocaine is transcending law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, as always, a conversation with you, Adrian, is so well informed, and also leaves us with more questions than answers, I reckon. But thank you for your time this morning. I know that people will enjoy this because it's such a polemic conversation, but not. It shouldn't be a polemic conversation. It should be an open conversation. So, thank you for your time. I've noticed that you're no longer on social media, so we have to go straight to Columbia Reports for our news. We don't see it on Twitter or on Facebook or anything else. Has that affected your readerships?
I don't know. I don't.
You don't look.
I don't look.
All right. Well, I know it. That your readers are loyal. They're still there. So, of course, everyone, do check out ColumbiaReports.com. Adrian is the director, the enfant terrible, the Renaissance man, as everyone likes to say, or, you know, just a little bit gonzo there in a barrio in Medellin. So thank you so much for your time and knowledge on this subject, Adrian.
Thanks for the invite.
No, it's a real pleasure. This has been episode 449 of the Columbia Calling podcast. We'll sign off after some messages from our sponsors, but thank you for listening.
The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. The Columbia Calling podcast is also proud to say that we are sponsored by BNB Columbia Tours, which is a leading tour operator in Colombia, providing a large range of private day tours, transportation, and bespoke packages throughout Colombia since 2017. By popular demand, from January 2023, they will be providing exclusive small group shared tours for those aged 50 and over. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's columbiacalling.co, or the Plan My Trip form on the BNB Columbia Tours website. That's bnbcolombia.com. And they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all your questions and to start the planning of your Columbia adventure. So please support our sponsors, our patrons here on the Columbia Calling podcast. That's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you again. Chinchorro y atarra.